Hello and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Renicus.
And I'm Ben Hooper. And welcome to our Christmas special podcast with an equally special guest, Adland legend Rory Sutherland.
Yeah, happy Christmas, Ben. I'm delighted that Rory has agreed to be Santa Sutherland and tell us all about his favourite Christmas ads. Plus, we'll be talking to him about his fascinating book, Alchemy, which I'm sure would be an ideal Christmas present for everyone who works in marketing.
Welcome and happy Christmas, Rory.
Oh, happy Christmas. My Nespresso advent calendar has just been cracked open for the first time. So, yes, absolutely.
We're on the home straight of this rather ropey race this year, aren't we? So, but thank you for joining us on the podcast. To our listeners, you almost certainly don't need much of an introduction, but here's what I know about you. You're vice chairman of Ogilvy UK, TED talker with over 7.5 million views worldwide in 30 languages, former president of the IPA, writer, direct marketer, broadcaster, creative director, and behavioral economics guru. Now, obviously, like a lot of those things you were doing were relevant to a moment in your career, but are any of those roles, which one of those really feels at home with you and why?
Oh, I'm still a direct marketer at heart. I mean, in both behavioral science and just generally understanding and becoming fascinated both by creativity and human behavior, the real epiphanies happened working with Drayton Bird, Steve Harrison, Mike Sim, Randy Hanfelder, and a bunch of people back in Ogilvy and Mather Direct in the late 80s, early 90s. Without that period in my life, nothing else would have happened. So I'm still a direct marketer, and I still think of things through a direct marketing lens. It never goes away.
Well, last Christmas, Rory, we got the whole Wax Lyrical podcast team together and we chose our favourite Christmas ads. And then we got our listeners to vote for their favourite. We even gave a John Lewis shopping voucher away to one of the voters. And top of the poll last year was IKEA. But of course, this year has been very different. So thanks for agreeing to be our advertising Santa and share your favourite Christmas ads with us. So what have you chosen and why? Tell us all about them.
Well, I've chosen four, and I suppose I like Coke. I like Boots. I like Great Ormond Street very much. I also like the John Lewis ad. I don't think any of them is what you might call a barnstormer, but then I'm not sure that's appropriate for the occasion. What I do like about all of them is that if you look at the Super Bowl, Christmas advertising in the UK, particularly retail advertising, but not exclusively so, has become the British Super Bowl. And the Super Bowl is interesting because you're allowed to spend big, because the audience is presumed to be enormous and the media cost is prodigious. I think Christmas is slightly different in British advertising because it's the time of year when you're actually allowed to go back to emotional selling. And I think not only in digital, but especially in digital advertising, but in all other forms of advertising, I think I agree with the thesis in Orlando Woods's book, which is called Lemon, How the Advertising Mind Turned Sour, that we have become disproportionately transactional and functionalist in our approach to advertising. We're seeing it as kind of information provision. And I think this misses a very large, probably the greater part of the value of advertising, which is creating emotional associations. You know, you can use Byron Sharp vocabulary to describe that, or you can use Paul Feldwick's arguments or Orlando's arguments to describe that. Paul Feldwick's next book, I think, is called Why Does the Peddler Sing, which is about the very, very long established relationship between selling and, in its broader sense, entertainment. And entertainment, I don't just mean fun or jokes, although it can very much mean fun or jokes. Okay. I also mean just, you know, creating material of strong emotional resonance. And I think we've lost that. And I think digital, I think, has encouraged us to lose it even more because we're measuring the wrong things. Of course. Not always badly. I mean, behavioral data is always more valuable than attitudinal data. But I think we're making a very, very dangerous mistake if we turn advertising into a short-term functionalist bottom of the funnel activity, pure and simple.
Rory's chosen four ads: Great Ormond Street, John Lewis, Boots, and Coke. in no particular order, why? What attracted you to those ads? Why do you think they're great ads?
You know, as a creative person, you know, I don't admire it massively, but nonetheless, it plays on something very, very powerful, which is the father-daughter relationship. As the father of two daughters, you have this very peculiar relationship with your female children, I think, which is that you, at the same time, you find them slightly maddening and annoying, but you know you'd unthinkingly take a bullet for them. And that's, you know, so I think tapping into that very peculiar element of parenthood, it always works with me. You know, in films like Taken, for example, exploit exactly that same relationship. And, you know, deep down, I think, the other great, I talked about direct marketing as an epiphany, and Darwinian psychology is my other kind of real passion. I think that behavioral economics really rests on evolutionary psychology. You know, the really robust findings are the ones that make sense in an evolutionary context. And, you know, that is undoubtedly one of, you know, the parental urge. And, you know, it's possibly one of the problems with having creative people who are too young, actually. It's something you don't understand until you experience it for yourself. And so it's a very, you know, it's a very, very potent ad, that whole business of separation and return. You know, it's the Odyssey. You know, it's as old as that, okay? And I do think that, you know, one of the slight problems, I love British advertising for its slight cynicism. I love British advertising for its acknowledgement that maybe the product isn't the most important thing in the consumer's life, which is where it historically differs slightly from American advertising. But sometimes I'm gonna kind of defend the Werther's original approach a little bit, okay, in that... you know, these are really, really strong forces. They're kind of human universals. They're really, really potent. And I think sometimes that kind of cynicism in British advertising causes people to dislike that approach. And the simple fact is, it survives because it works.
The other one that you chose was Boots, and I was not sure about those ads that had a charity feel this year. I think I've had my fill of charity stuff, but over to you, Rory. Why do you think the Boots one was particularly good?
No, I'm going to defend this because I think being useful simply... It is Christmas, after all, you know, and I think... I'm not a thinking slave to the idea of purpose by any means. But one of the best things you can do, I think, in a crisis is demonstrate that you're useful and helpful. And so anything that does that, and the donation of essential soaps to people, for example, was an extremely useful act. Anything that is altruistic and anything that is pro-social that has a profit motive is always given vastly less credit than something that's purely altruistic, okay? And it's a known problem in behavioral science that actually, you know, when someone's making money out of something, we never express... I mean, if I went in and said, haven't my electricity company been wonderful, okay, they've kept the lights on, you know, okay, totally unfashionable opinion, my broadband for 8 months has gone wonky for about 30 minutes. Okay, that's an astonishing achievement if you consider the huge extra volume of demand that's been put on the data network. Okay, now, you know, I'm not suggesting for a second let's go outside and clap for BT. Okay, I think that's asking too much, but it is worth remembering. It's, you know, it's the Adam Smith kind of point, which is that actually Adam Smith was actually more cynical than that. He said, I never know much good done by organizations which affect to trade for the public good. He was very skeptical about that. But I think we ought to just remind ourselves of the fact that, you know, the real, alongside the health services and other frontline workers, grocery retail logistics, okay, have come out of this really well. I started in early March thinking, okay, and so we had loo paper shortages. That was entirely irrational, but there you go, these things happen. But I was basically thinking in March, you know, that in about 4 weeks' time, we'll be down to my wife and I debating which potato we should save for tomorrow. And instead, I think you had a period where for a couple of weeks, I had to eat my second favorite brand of breakfast cereal because the shipments of grape nuts. I don't, does anybody else agree? The one thing I have in common with David Ogilvy, it was David Ogilvy's favorite food. And David Ogilvy, as a well-known crank, would occasionally go to a Michelin three-star restaurant and demands to eat grape nuts. It was described by someone, a Catholic friend of mine who's an Abbot Mead Vicars. One of his other Catholic friends described grape nuts as the most Protestant of all breakfast cereals because they're kind of grit, which you you soak in milk. But, you know, there was a brief two-week period where I think the grape nuts weren't making it over from the US. But that logistical achievement, by the way, in terms of keeping everybody not just fed, but not even having a morale loss through, oh my God, you know, I can't get this and I can't get that. It may, you know, imagine a parallel universe where there'd been significant food shortages and the level of panic and anxiety would have been inordinately higher, along with, of course, the level of rule breaking would have been inordinately higher. And so, you know, I mean, clap for those in grocery retail logistics is never going to be a popular movement. But I mean, my God, you know, what an achievement when you think about it.
So do you think that's going to change, though? Because, like, in all the research that gets done around sort of certain age groups, the generations sort of coming through now into sort of consumerism, sort of like from 18 plus, or just maybe younger than that, is there less cynicism? Are we going to start seeing a shift? Because obviously, yeah, where we are now, people are going to be sceptical of brands to do good. It still feels a bit uncomfortable for a lot of people. But I don't know. I feel that maybe that cynicism is waning, and I think it'll be more of an expected thing.
Yes. No. I mean, the first thing, by the way, is don't do bad. Okay. Mm. So when we talk about purpose, you know, the value of actually having some purpose other than your own immediate self-enrichment, first of all, it's vitally important, if not as an advertising message, okay, it's vitally important for employee motivation and focus. So as an internal message, you know, do I get out of bed every morning to enrich WPP's shareholders? I have to be absolutely honest with you and say that I do not do that. You know, they very rarely are anywhere in my thoughts, to be absolutely honest, in doing what
Can
I'm
we use that to. As a quote for the, for the promo assets?
I don't want to be really harsh about this. I'm never quite clear in advertising what the shareholders actually do. Because it's not exactly a capital-intensive business, is it, right? You know, I could start an ad agency with a credit card and a trip to a brunch at Curry's. So not entirely clear what these people are actually doing, if I'm going to be blunt about it. You know, it's not like a factory or, you know, the 18th century where before you could actually start, you know, production, you needed to invest huge amounts in plant. So anyway, but I'll park that slightly anarchic thought there. And but nonetheless, no, I mean, you know, having some sense of motivation, where I don't like it is where it oversteps the line into divisive political campaigning under the guise of purpose. Okay. And one of the things I'd argue about that is it's a very bad idea to alienate part of your customer base. I mean, that's a Byron Sharp point, I think. You know, it's before you do anything else, the vital thing you have to be as a brand is not actively rejected by people. Okay. You have to be somewhere inside their acceptable repertoire for a very large number of people. And so where I dislike it is where it becomes preachy. And where it becomes highly divisive. If you think about it, okay, I've advised, by the way, people like Extinction Rebellion on this. I said, look, when you're amongst your other Extinction Rebellion mates, it looks really cool to spray fuck on a war memorial, right? Do not spray fuck on a war memorial, okay? Because you do inestimably more harm by doing that than you ever do good. It's a bit like, you know, it's one of those things that in a very, very extreme group of a peer group, okay, behavior that annoys your opposition is a bit of a status boost, and it's probably a bit of a kind of endorphin rush. Have you ever seen, I say this, have you ever seen an ad for Ford which insults the drivers of General Motors vehicles or sets out to offend them? You have not, because sensibly, Ford realizes that those people are their future customers. Okay. And so this business of politics where you judge the success of your activity by how much it annoys people who disagree with you is really, really fatal. And it can get played, by the way. There's a really clever, it was ingenious, but evil. About 20 years ago in California, there was this campaign basically to teach Latino children Spanish at school. It was a bit of a dodgy campaign because it was funded by English language schools who realized that they could make a fortune effectively charging people who'd been taught Spanish at school and then charging them to learn English in order to get a job as a lawyer or, any kind of, white collar job would basically require English in California. And so it was very dodgy. But the people, they organized a protest in favor of it. People very, very cunningly went around. And it was a lot of kind of very worthy liberals in the audience who are very, very sort of multinational and multicultural and everything else. And these very clever right-wing infiltrators went into the march and handed out Mexican flags. And, of course, the people on the march thought, this is lovely, I can demonstrate my, et cetera. Of course, the people watching on television went batshit insane, which was, if you come to America, you wave an American flag, right? You don't march through the streets of Los Angeles waving Mexican flags. It's fundamentally, and it was one of those things that makes, a bit like Neil Kinnock's All Right, okay? It's fine in the hall, it's a catastrophe on television. And I think, I think that mistake is made by advertising people time and time again. I occasionally say that, the worst of purpose is advertising planners saying, I've given up on understanding the consumer. So what I'm going to try and do is make all consumers more and more like advertising planners, like slightly Guardian-Easter-ish, kind of a bit kind of, a bit bloody worthy. So this will make life a lot easier. If we can make all customers a bit like planners, then my job will be easier. No. The job of the planner is to understand people, okay? It's not to impress your own personality on them.
Well, talking of planners, do you think the planners were heavily involved in that Great Ormond Street ad, which is another emotional one, but why was that on your favourite list?
Oh, it's just very sweetly executed. What I'm doing is deliberate. Okay, I've got to appear on a music programme, okay, later on, and I think all my selection of music, it's kind of the kind of music program where most people are choosing, I might be Brian Eno or very, very cool music, and I think I might go on with a pure country music selection, okay, which is, I'm a very big fan of things that are underrated, okay, and I think, all of us, I think, in advertising underrate this simple, emotional, highly emotive power in messages, because it makes us feel a bit uncomfortable. We'd much rather say something like really, really clever, okay, which is, don't get me wrong, no one loves a good, a good punning gag in a headline more than me, but I think British advertising is very, very good at what it does well, but I don't think it covers the waterfront fully. And so I'm deliberately siding with ads which, to be honest, which don't appeal to the, I'm going to go all alt right now. I'm going to start talking about the mainstream media and the technocratic elite. There's a very particular kind of thing in the kind of elite opinion in the UK, which is highly dismissive of opinion. Okay. And that causes, I think, people, particularly the highly educated, to fundamentally misunderstand the drivers that operate in most of society. I'm like Dave Trott, I'm a very big fan. One of the worst things you can do, I think, is reject genres. So the worst thing you can do as a music lover, when most music lovers tend, the genre that tends to get rejected most are rap, country, and metal, I guess, because they're often liked by people who aren't very cool. Okay, but the best of country or the best, the best of metal is utterly fantastic, okay? So you're making a huge mistake to start segmenting music by category before you then decide what to like. And in the same way, I think we make that slight mistake, which is Brits are a bit of, particularly kind of educated Brits who want to show off their cool points are a bit embarrassed about plays to the emotion. But, every great film is based on exactly that, let's be honest.
We've talked a lot about kind of this kind of stuff already, and like I think it's sort of, but it's worth sort of bringing it back to your book, which came out in 2019. And like, you know, like anyone who's sort of in our industry who's read it, it's fascinating, it's funny, it's really sort of like really sort of interesting, incredibly useful as well for how we think about challenges and how we have to remind ourselves of all the things you've just been talking about. Overall, I think I took it personally as a like a rallying cry for creativity that sort of challenges logical approaches and the challenging of logical approaches.
And it's actually a rallying cry for the value of marketing, which is this is the great philosophical question. One of the things I learned being president of the IPA, okay, is that all ad agencies are fixated on completely the wrong thing, which is, does my marketing director love me? And am I slightly better than DDB or am I slightly worse than DDB? Okay. Now, that is actually a totally trivial consideration. The real problem we face is that the dominant business culture in most organizations is deeply hostile to the idea that marketing creates value, because it's an efficiency culture. Okay, which derives, I think, from economics. I think it derives from, and it also derives from goods dominant logic. And this is, I'm getting really nerdy here. There's an academic field of behavioral science called service dominant logic, which argues that nearly all models of value creation are totally wrongly based on the assumption that someone's buying a good. Whereas even if you sell goods, and especially if you sell services, the person is buying a service, and the way you think about services is fundamentally, and the creation of value within a service is fundamentally different, okay? And it's much more, it plays much greater acknowledgement to psychology than goods dominant logic does, where I'm basically buying the thing and the value is created in the factory and anything else is a cost. Now, okay, we were just talking about this fascinatingly by someone who's working with a car company. And notice this, okay, that all those people are now, all car companies are trying to sell cars direct online because they're seeing the dealership as a cost, okay, because they're assuming the person is buying a car. Now, I don't want to criticize Elon Musk because he's, you know, literally 10 orders of magnitude richer than I am, and he's an extraordinarily brilliant guy. I'm not sure the idea to try and sell a Tesla without a test drive is a great idea, actually, okay? He's done it very well because the choice architecture on the website is brilliantly minimalistic, so you can actually choose a Tesla without worrying about experiencing regret. So he's done that very well. If you're going to buy cars direct, I think this whole business of the tech industry, which is trying to optimize instrumental efficiency rather than emotional efficiency, is deeply dangerous. And I think this is the whole point I make, which is I realize that everything that ad agencies worry about is actually, broadly speaking, trivial, because When Mark and I started in this business, okay, two-thirds of ad spend was packaged goods. It was Unilever, Reckitt's or Brewers, that kind of thing. It was FMCG stuff of one kind or another. Now it's less than a third, right? And actually, I think it was two-thirds of ad spend was packaged goods until about, certainly until the mid-90s. Okay. Now, those companies, marketing was a serious discipline. Okay. You know, the chief executive had done a 5-year stint in marketing. It was a very, very large expense to them. They took it very seriously. They did see it as being an essential part of value creation. Okay. What's taken up the slack is now companies like insurance comparison websites, mobile phone handset manufacturers, broadband providers, cable TV providers. Okay. When you have a tech or engineering culture, their attitude to marketing is bordering on the hostile. They see it as a cost, not as a source of value or a source of growth. They see it as an inefficiency, by the way. Okay. And I think this is incredibly dangerous because, perfect example, Mark Evans, who's a brilliant guy, I think, the marketing director of Direct Line. He had somebody who was put on secondment in Direct Line to the marketing function from somewhere like data analytics, perfectly sensible secondment. And the guy's first reaction was, I don't know why they put me in marketing because I'm rubbish at drawing. Right. Now, if we don't solve that problem, Okay. Yeah. Worrying about whether we're slightly better or slightly worse than DDB is not going to be our biggest concern, because, and you notice it, Peter Thiel writes about this, you know, that the instinctive engineering mindset believes that, and it comes from economics, okay? So economics assumes perfect trust and perfect information. All economic models assume that we know exactly what we want, how much utility we'll derive from them, how much we're therefore willing to pay for that product, and we completely trust the person who's selling it to us to deliver on the expected promise. Now, under those conditions, marketing wouldn't need to exist, I freely admit. You know, if we lived in that weird parallel universe, okay, marketing would be an inefficiency. Be unnecessary. You produce the product as cheaply as you possibly can, and more people buy it. The fact that we don't live in that world seems to be rather significant, because nonetheless, it's the world that most business people prefer to occupy, because it's completely quantifiable and it gives you a simple, measurable task, which is, can you make the product objectively better in some objective dimension, or can you make it more cheaply? As if those are the only two important things going on. Now, interestingly, I was with a bunch of people from Nokia on the day the first iPhone came out, and they were quite dismissive because they were looking at the objective qualities of the iPhone. You've got to remember as well that the iPhone, there was no app store with the first iPhone. So you basically had a calculator, okay? You had a phone, you had a calendar, you had an email thing, and you had a browser, and you had a thing that told you the weather. That was basically it, right? And they were all going, well, I mean, I'm pretty skeptical because, I mean, the battery life's terrible, which it was, by the way. I mean, battery life's awful, doesn't even last you the whole day. And they went on with a whole list of things, you know, the processing power's not that spectacular, blah, blah, blah. What they completely missed is that what matters about a phone is not what it can do in engineering terms. It's how you feel while you're doing it. Now, because we don't have emotional metrics, what we're trying to do is we're trying to use big data and we're trying to use data analytics to map objective reality like price and speed and size and processing power, okay? And we're trying to map that onto human behavior as though there were a neat relationship between the two. But we don't actually respond to objective qualities. We respond to feelings. And the feelings are generated not by facts, but by meaning and the meaning we attach to something. That's why, you know, Avis is number two in rental cars, so we try harder is so extraordinary, because Avis is number two in rental cars is actually an ad for Hertz, right? It's a weakness, okay? Until you add four words, so we try harder, and you add meaning to it, which is, no, this doesn't mean, as you might have assumed, we don't have quite the same range of cars, we won't be at more obscure airports, you know, we don't enjoy economies of scale, okay? Suddenly it says, what it means is we'll just make a bit more effort on your behalf. So that's service dominant logic, actually, adding those four words, okay? So we try harder. I'll tell you a lovely statistic, which always strikes me as perfect in service dominant logic, which is Alex Batchelor. When he worked for Royal Mail, they did a whole amount of work on what affected people's brand attitude towards Royal Mail as a business, okay? And they looked at everything, you know, advertising, PR, reliability of service, how early in the morning your mail arrived, all this shit, right? Do you know the biggest determinant by far? Whether you liked your postman. And actually, that is also an example of that we care more about, you know, how you do things and how it makes us feel. And there are certain emotions which only a human can deliver. So the Silicon Valley Project, what I call the doorman fallacy, which is you replace a hotel doorman with an automatic door. You take a hotel doorman, you go, there's a human, we've got to get rid of him, because that's basically what tech people do. They go, shit, there's something organic in the mix. How do we replace this with an algorithm? Okay, and you define the doorman's function as opening the door. You replace him with an infrared door opening mechanism, okay? And then you declare yourself, and I think management can consultancy does this as well, okay? You then say, look, we've saved £30,000 a year on a doorman, okay? What a brilliant success. Can we please lay claim to this wonderful cost saving? What you don't notice is the invisible cost of that decision, which is the doorman also provided recognition. He provided security. He provided status. He hailed cabs, you know. 6 months later, you know, there are three winos asleep in the doorway and your rack rate's fallen off a cliff. I always say, you know, what gives you your biggest competitive advantage in marketing is the ability to do things your finance director doesn't like. Okay. And that's why Steve Jobs created a $1 trillion company, because he actually had power. I would argue now they've been taken over by the finance director, we can expect a long-term decline. Okay. Because the power to do things that your finance director, who is basically has the mindset of an economist, finds repellently inefficient, is precisely the thing that makes you distinctive, because you're doing something you didn't have. Mark will remember this. We're going to get a trip down memory lane now, right, Mark? You'll remember buying a cassette deck in the 1980s when, you know, you could read a Rich Review, which would tell you about battery life and sound quality and reproductive quality and all those facets of, you know, a build quality, right? But you chose a cassette deck by pressing the eject button, didn't you? And if it had a lovely cantilevered kind of, you know, hydraulic hiss to the opening of the cassette drawer, okay, that's lovely, okay. And if it just went clack, you said, that's manifestly garbage, I'm not going to give this any house room. And this would drive rational people and engineers practically insane. But we use heuristics like that to make judgments about the mindset of the person who made the device. And someone who pays attention to something which is, strictly speaking, unnecessary, strangely impresses us disproportionately more. And I find that absolutely fascinating, actually. And I think that that literally thing, the fact that finance people instinctively hate marketing is the really important question we've got to solve. And one good thing about behavioral economics is if you go to your finance director and say, I'm going to talk to you today about psychology, okay, he's not going to listen. I think we make a mistake talking about brands, by the way, not because brands aren't important. They're very important. But as soon as you say brand to CEO, they say, talk to my marketing director. That's not my affair. Okay, ridiculous, but nonetheless true. If you talk about behavioral economics, and I discovered this, you know, when I talked about advertising, I got invited to advertising conferences or marketing conferences. When I started talking about behavioral economics, I got invited to 10 Downing Street. Now, I don't know about you, Mark, but to be honest, if a plane's delayed 20 minutes or half an hour or 45 minutes, it doesn't bother me that much. Okay, as long as I know it's 45 minutes, you go to the lounge, you in Geneva Airport, I got my hair cut, you know, you find something else to do, okay? Yeah, a transatlantic westbound flight, it really doesn't matter that much because you're not doing anything that evening anyway when you arrive. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that there is a correlation, but it's created by uncertainty. It's not created by duration. Now, you could set out to spend millions making planes more punctual and making taxis turn up sooner, only for Uber to wrong-foot you by creating a map. Because once you know where the car is, you're no longer anxious waiting for the car, okay? So the map, which costs Uber next to nothing, okay, it was inspired by watching Goldfinger, would you believe it, and the time when Bond tracks Ulrich Goldfinger through the Swiss Alps by placing a tracker device on his Rolls Royce. Now, obviously, when you're following someone and you want to remain discreet, the obvious car in which to do that is an Aston Martin DB6, isn't it? But anyway, he remains out of sight because he's got this tracker device, and he has a kind of scrolling map in the dashboard of the DB6, which shows in a flashing dot where Goldfinger's car is. And the guy who co-founded Uber said that's what should happen when you order a taxi. And in every case, we're looking at these objective metrics and trying to improve them, okay? Not always a waste of time, okay? I'm not suggesting that all instrumental improvement in efficiency is a waste of time, but eventually it becomes more and more expensive because you hit the law of diminishing returns. And actually, with an airline, far more important than your flights being punctual is for passenger satisfaction is the quality of your information. Okay, it delayed 45 minutes, delayed even, you know, 90 minutes. Okay, is inordinately less stressful than simply BA246 delayed. BA246 delayed sets people into a state of complete panic. They know there's bad information, but they don't have enough information to act on it. Does this mean I'm going to miss my meeting? Is this a precursor to saying cancelled? You know, will I get bumped? You know, what do I do? And so what we're doing is we're actually optimizing for the confounding objective variable rather than the genuine emotional variable. And it's very expensive to do. Making Eurostar faster when you could have put Wi-Fi on the train was a really, really expensive. Do you want to know the weirdest one? Okay. And I want someone to come and rubbish me on this. Okay. The point of High Speed 2 is reduce the journey time to Manchester. Okay. And also increase capacity on the trains to Manchester. And I said, that's the brief, capacity and journey time reduction. Okay. I said, I can do that for you, and I can do it not in 15 years costing 60 billion. I can do it with £500,000 and maybe a bit of an advertising budget, okay, to promote the thing. And I can do it for you in about 6 months. Why? I said, don't define the length of the journey as the time spent on the train. That's the best bit of the journey. I can get on with some work. Okay. I like the trip to Manchester on the train. Define it as end-to-end journey time. Now, every time I travel to Manchester, I buy an advance ticket, okay, because otherwise it costs £1 billion, which means I have to catch that train, which means I leave a huge margin of error and I turn up at Euston 45 minutes before the train leaves, okay? I then spend 45 minutes hanging around Burger King waiting for my train to leave. In that time, two earlier trains, 20 and 40 minutes before my train, leave for Manchester, and they're half empty. Okay. Now, if you just had an app which said, "Oi, I'm at Euston," and the app said, "Pay us £6 and you can board the train in 5 minutes' time and sit in seat J8. If you pay us £5 or £3, you can board the seat in 25 minutes' time and sit in seat J10. Okay? Because those trains are leaving half empty. Now, in yield management terms, you always want people to board an earlier train if there's spare capacity, if there's unsold capacity, because you then free up capacity on later trains and your load balancing is much better. Okay. EasyJet lets you do this. If you turn up really, really early for an EasyJet flight back to Gatwick in time to catch the earlier flight, they got empty seats on the earlier flight. They let you get on the earlier flight for free. Shouldn't let people travel later, but earlier is fine. Now, I've just reduced the journey time by 20 to 40 minutes, okay, end to end as defined properly, which is, you know, the time wasted, not time spent on the train, which is valuable time, okay? And I've increased capacity. It costs you £500,000. Why are we prepared to spend 60 billion on an engineering solution before we've even instigated that, okay? You could do that. It's a fucking rounding error compared to the cost of High Speed 2. Right? Okay, it's three McKinsey wankers for a couple of weekends, right? So what on earth are we doing? You know, I mean, seriously, because this is really serious, because we're measuring things, we're mismeasuring. What gets mismeasured gets mismanaged. And we always measure what happens to be easily quantifiable, not what's important, because what's important is emotional and it's non-linear and it's not numerical. I mean, Peter Thiel, very good tech guy, who unusually for a tech guy really understands the importance of marketing, says, if you've got a brilliant, brilliant invention and product, but you don't know how to sell it, what you've got is a lousy business. And I mean, one thing that really intrigues me is that if you think about it, you know that story about the World War II and the planes are coming back, right? And they look at where the bullet holes are on the planes. And they say, okay, that's where the planes seem to be getting hit. Let's add extra armor in those. You can't armor the whole plane because it'd be too heavy to fly. So let's add extra armor in the places where the bullet holes are, right? And a brilliant Columbia mathematician stopped them from doing it. And he said, no. The planes you need to be looking at aren't the ones that made it back to base. They're the planes in the bottom of the North Sea. You need to be adding armor where the bullet holes aren't, because you're suffering from survivorship bias. Now, one thing that occurs to me and terrifies me is you never get a case study written about a business that failed because it failed to do any marketing, because we don't notice those companies when they disappear. Okay? So essentially, there isn't any kind of catalogue of there is one extraordinary example, by the way. HTC was the biggest mobile phone handset manufacturer in the United States. It outsold the iPhone, okay, in aggregate.
It's gone now, isn't it?
They haven't made a mobile handset since 2018. Wow. HTC's strapline was quietly brilliant, okay. Now, you could say it isn't, but you could say that Samsung's strapline is noisily brilliant, okay? They realize if you want to compete with Apple, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to create a hell of a lot of noise, right? You know, and interestingly, HTC disappeared without anybody noticing, which was quietly brilliant, was their strapline. And by the way, the products were fantastic. You know, objectively, I think they made very, very good handsets. But they literally disappeared without trace. That's one of the things that concerns me. Is we you know, I think that there are hundreds of brilliant ideas every year which fail because we got the marketing wrong. I think there is an extraordinary mystery. I was talking to a company that does AI. I said, gosh, tell me what your last project was. And they said, we got a brilliant engineer in, and we managed to use AI to make a completely silent electric toothbrush. Okay. And I said, really interesting, terrible fucking idea. Because we judge the efficacy of our toothbrush in part, and we judge how hard we push, okay, by the noise. Okay, a really silent electric toothbrush we'll think isn't doing a very good job of cleaning our teeth. Okay, now, interestingly, there's a case where Raymond Loewy, the most brilliant designer, produced something similar, where he invented something which was incredibly quiet and discovered that actually it was a disaster because people actually used them. Oh, it's a fan. Sorry, it was a fan. Raymond Loewy produced a fan which was astoundingly silent, and it didn't cool people down. Because basically, there's a placebo effect with fans, which is the noise is partly what makes us think that we're being cooled. Okay? And we judge the strength of the, you know, airstream in part by the noise generated by the fan. And so if you don't understand those perceptual things, you can actually spend hours and a huge amount of genius optimizing something you shouldn't be optimizing at all. They'll now probably have to add some sort of loudspeaker in the device to make a really interesting noise, or otherwise we'll think the thing's a bit rubbish.
In the same way that Toyota Priuses were thinking about making an engine noise when they were quiet, yeah?
Yeah, no, actually, you may have to do that for road safety purposes as well, because there's some slightly weird findings with electric cars, which is that people walk out in front of them.
Yeah.
And it's called skeuomorphic design, by the way, where you build in a familiar. There was actually, believe it or not, a car called the Horsey Horseless that had a fake horse on the front in the very early days of the automobile, with the idea that it wouldn't panic other horses. But the reason your digital camera has to make a click when you press the button is because that's what you expect a camera to do. And so skeuomorphic design it's like building in a knob to a digital radio. You know, it's basically. Raymond Loewy understood this. I think it was what he called maximally acceptable innovation, which is if you innovate too fast, nobody can actually mentally. It's very similar, actually, to positioning the battle for your mind, I think. You know, Jamaica, what was it? The Caribbean, Hawaii. You know, isn't that a fucking fantastic book, by the way? and it's, you know, it's a great behavioral science book, really, because it says people make sense of things by comparison, not by, you know, objective perception. And therefore, you know, I mean, we judge price by comparison. We don't judge it by cost, really. I always said, you know, that's the great Nespresso genius. You know, we compare it to Starbucks. We don't compare it to Maxwell House.
Rory, you know that I could listen to you for ages. Let me tell you my Rory story. I don't know whether you remember this, but it was the Ogilvy 50th anniversary. I was a young thrusting account executive at Ogilvy with you in those days, and I'd been summoned to Cannes for the 50th anniversary, and we were all in a very large conference hall, and I think Shelley Lazarus was addressing us in her beautiful red dress, standing in the spotlight in the middle of the conference hall, and she introduced the guest of honor to the entire Ogilvy anniversary. It was you, and you couldn't be there. I don't know why, but you couldn't be there. You were on video, and you had recorded a video message. It was one of the most uplifting, insightful, funny things I have ever seen in my life. And considering it was pre-recorded, you even knew how long to leave a pause as the audience were hilariously laughing at your gags. You are such a warm, and you know, my overriding memory of working with you, Rory, is you not only are brilliant, but you are a very kind person. That's one of my memories of you. So thank you for joining us on this Christmas special.
Yeah, I don't think it's helped me in my career, actually. I always think the problem with advertising, okay, is there are people motivated by curiosity, there are people motivated by greed, and there are people motivated by power. And the great tragedy is everybody gets what they want.
Well, I've learned a hell of a lot. I've got some notes here, which I'm going to turn into the next client presentation. I hope you don't mind me sort of paraphrasing you, Rory. But yeah, I think it's been absolutely fascinating chatting to you. And obviously, we wish you a very, very Merry Christmas.
I actually do look forward to seeing you in person very soon,
yeah,
Rory. Hopefully in 2021, we can do that. Have a wonderful time. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you,
Rory. Happy Christmas, Marketing Society. Wonderful stuff.